Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for you as usual as we close out the work week. And, Jim, we start with the good, and we've had appearances from CNBC's Rick Santelli before, usually not exactly low-key in whatever he has to say, and that was the same way in his latest rant, this one in response to the fact that the Obama administration is once again calling for emergency unemployment benefits. He says after 5 years, it's hard to call it an emergency. But he warns even further that it's probably not a good idea to go down this road because even François Hollande in France has already tried it and admitted it's a failure.
If what the president said is true, just throwing money at this is good for the economy, then I challenge him to look at the extreme viewpoint in this regard from François Hollande, the president of France, a socialist, who is tried everything the president is talking about and now is throwing up the right flag. And a journal story today, here's what President François Hollande said. How can we run a country if entrepreneurs don't hire? And how can we redistribute wealth if there is no wealth?
So, Jim, it might not do any good given Obama's proclivities, but one of the nice things about having the Europeans go down a horrible path before us is that we see where we're headed, and if anybody's paying attention, hopefully we'll change course.
Greg, I completely agree. I would say that Santelli is one of the loudest voices for the policies we'd like to see enacted. He's loudest because everyone behind him at the Chicago Board of Trade won't quiet down when he's on the television. But he's always yelling at us on CNBC. One of the things that I find kind of useful about this, it is a useful argument to make to folks. Like, maybe part of the problem is that we have not made our arguments from the self-interest of the Democratic lawmakers we would wish to influence and change the minds of. And his point about you can't redistribute wealth if you're not creating wealth in the first place. It's kind of a very basic point, but it kind of illuminates things, that all of the things that Obama wants government to do, whether it's in terms of health care, whether it's in terms of, you know, investing in clean energy, you know, most of these are bad ideas, but some of them aren't terrible. But even whether they're good or bad, we need a thriving economy to generate the income and the investments and all that stuff that can be brought in through tax revenues. And by the way, a booming economy does better for tax revenues than any type of tax hike you could possibly pass. And from there, the government, you know, would have a lower deficit and more money to spend on all these good things that Obama wants to spend it on. So by trying to put the argument in terms Obama can understand and from his own self-interest, I salute Rick Santelli. I'm not expecting any dramatic change in the approach from this administration, but maybe some of those red and purple state Democrats in Congress might start, you know, waking up and smelling the coffee here.
We hope. I guess it all depends on how lousy their poll numbers look here as they get closer to a midterm election. But yeah, the handwriting is definitely on the wall across the Atlantic, and we're headed there if we don't change course in a pretty substantial way. All right. Speaking of not headed towards insolvency, that kind of dovetails a little bit into our second martini. It was just earlier this week, Jim, that we were pretty happy about the fact that Jim Moran was not going to be running for re-election in the state of Virginia. He's been there almost 24 years, and as you put it, he's a liberal lawmaker, but he's an even worse person. We got the exact opposite of that, unfortunately, in Oklahoma. Tom Coburn is in his second Senate term. He has announced that he will serve the rest of this year, but not serve the final 2 years remaining in his second six-year term. He is currently battling prostate cancer, but he says that's not why he's leaving office. He says he can do more for his children and grandchildren by leaving office. This is a guy who came to the House in the 1994 Republican wave, was one of the few to honor his term limit pledge of 3 2-year terms, came back in 2004, won that Senate seat in Oklahoma in a pretty tough race, and won it very easily again in 2010. He's a guy who's at the forefront of the spending and debt debate. He's a guy who tell you exactly what he thinks. And for the most part, he's a very serious and sober guy. Mitch McConnell said Coburn was one of the most decent, principled, and intelligent men in modern Senate history. So pretty high praise there, and I don't think there's many conservatives who would disagree with that.
Yeah, I think you said a lot of it there, Greg. But I would point out, though, that I remember when I way back in what seems like a previous lifetime, it was 1999, I was writing for Congressional Quarterly, and I was covering the floor of the House, and I had to write up something on every vote that the House took. And they were fighting over some spending bill, and Coburn was submitting one amendment after the other. This was back when it was a lot easier for members of the House to submit them. And so he was like, all right, I want to cut $155,000 from, you know, like $500,000 from the farm bill. in this program, and they would get the vote would get rejected. You turn around and say, okay, I want to eliminate 400,000 from that stuff, which made my life, you know, being the vote coverer, much more complicated. But it said something about his persistence and his determination and maybe even his stubbornness, knowing that most of these amendments were going to get voted down and trying to go, all right, so how small a cut can I propose till it becomes palatable to you spenders? And I think it just says something about his doggedness and his determination and also kind of the usefulness of getting everybody on record voting against really minuscule cuts to programs that he deemed wasteful. He's always great for spotlighting the pork book and the pork barrel spending that always seemed ridiculous. And as you said, also just a enormously decent guy, and a guy who was really good at actually like making all of his points and making a position that, let's face it, isn't that popular in Washington. Most people love spending, particularly their own spending. And he managed to do it in a way that was not terribly antagonistic. A happy warrior, shall we say. It's very depressing to hear. He says it's not health related. You can't help but wonder if, you know, but be concerned about something like that. But also, like, you see Jim DeMint heading off to this Heritage. You see Coburn leaving. We elect some of these good guys, you know, these good, strong conservatives. And then sometimes they leave the stage a little bit earlier than you would like. And it really can be very frustrating. The Moran comparison is appropriate because I am as bummed and depressed about Coburn leaving as I was happy about Moran leaving. I liked it better when we were getting Moran for nothing instead of, you know, de facto trading Moran for Coburn. That's a tough one right there.
Absolutely right. And talk about being consistent. Not only is he one of the very few people who have honored his term limit pledges. In fact, this one he's leaving even earlier than he pledged. But he's saving money all the way up to the end. He could step down now, I suppose, if he felt like he really needed to. But then there would probably be a special election at the end of the year. And this way, he stays in through the end of the year. More than likely, Mary Fallon will be reelected as governor of Oklahoma. She will appoint a successor, and there won't be any election for that seat up until the point where it would have been up anyway. So he saved the state probably a few million dollars in just the timing of his own decision.
Money saving. I also point out that, you know, look, it's Oklahoma. Chances are whoever replaces Coburn is probably going to be a conservative Republican. The Oklahoma Democratic Party bench is down to like two guys. but a lawmaker is more than their voting record. And we'll see who replaces Coburn in the Senate. There'll probably be another conservative Republican. Really remains to be seen if it's somebody who's willing to fight the dogged fight and be the leader the way Coburn was. So a very depressing bad martini today.
Yeah, definitely so. And we certainly wish the best for Tom Coburn. As we mentioned, he's going to be involved in, you know, the debates the rest of this year. But we certainly wish him all the best as he heads home at the end of the year as well. On to the third martini now. And Jim, once again, it's back. This started probably from decent motivations in the days following the shooting of Gabby Giffords now 3 years ago, right before the State of the Union. And Republicans and Democrats sat next to each other to show unity as the president addressed the country. But it keeps going on. And here's the reason. Ron Barber of Arizona, Democrat, he actually holds Giffords' old seat. This is the story from the Tucson Sentinel. Southern Arizona Democrat Ron Barber joined a bipartisan group urging senators and representatives to cross party lines, at least to sit together at President Obama's January 28th State of the Union address. Barber, along with U.S. Rep. Matt Salmon, Arizona Republican, Democratic Senator Mark Udall of Colorado, and Alaska GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski, urged colleagues to repeat the aisle crossing begun in 2011. Here's Barber's quote. I came to Congress with an open mind, ready to work with Republicans and Democrats, with those I agree and those I disagree, to find common sense solutions to our nation's challenges. As we come together at the State of the Union and pledge to work for the common good of Americans, we must not divide ourselves on partisan lines. And Jim, if anyone's paid attention to Washington since this started, I'm pretty sure this hasn't fostered a whole lot of bipartisanship.
No, you know, it's such a non-entity and such a non-factor that trashing this idea, Greg, I don't know about you, I feel a little bit like I'm kicking a puppy, you know. But at the same time, it is so inconsequential. I guess one idea is, well, I was going to applaud the president, but I'm not going to because the guy next to me is, or I'm going to not applaud, but now I'm in between two Democrats, so maybe I will. Like the idea of this getting into the congressional psychology of whether or not you applaud or whether or not you offer a negative reaction is kind of disturbing about how vulnerable to suggestion members of Congress could be. Ultimately, you know, when most people think of partisanship, the issue isn't really the reaction of the State of the Union. It really is the differences in policies and whether you vote yay or nay. And ultimately, this comes down to the fact that we have two parties with very different ideologies. And when people say, oh, I wish we could have more bipartisanship, what they really mean is, oh, I wish people could be less principled, and I wish they would stop holding true to what they really believe, and I wish they would just compromise for the sake of compromise. You know, it's very whiny, and it's, you know, like, look, are there times where it'd be nice to reach some compromise? Sure. Ultimately, you know, everybody wants the other guy to compromise more than their side does. Compromise is a nice idea in theory, but I guess it really matters on what you're compromising about, right? We can compromise on stuff that isn't that important to us, but if it's really important to us, it's very difficult to compromise. This is why Barack Obama hasn't really pushed for much entitlement reform in these last 5 years, and the prospects for any serious entitlement reform are pretty sparse for the next 3 years. Ultimately, that's not something he wants to compromise on. This really, you know, small consequence, you know, gesture that if Ron Barber, it makes him feel good, makes everybody else feel good. I guess I shouldn't, you know, wag my finger too much. But one aspect which you might want to extend further is that if these guys actually did have more of a interpersonal reaction outside of the legislative process, then maybe they'd be a little more respectful to each other during those debates. And it would be less my opponent, you know, this guy is really wrong as opposed to this guy is really a bad guy. But that's, you know, kind of a different ball of wax. And so, you know, I of the million problems in Washington, 1,000,001 would probably be the seating arrangement at the State of the Union address, Greg.
Yes. And there's the good news, bad news. If you're looking for a Democrat to sit with and you want to be seen on television, pick Sheila Jackson Lee or Elliot Engel, because they get there like 4 hours early to save seats on the aisle so they can be seen shaking his hand. On the flip side, you might have to show up at 4 or 5 o'clock to get the seat next to them. So
it always seemed like time well spent, right? You know? I'm not getting nothing done State of the Union Day because I got to get my seats early. I don't know. Do you like go back at home and replay the State of the Union coverage and say, look, there I am. That's me. Kind of like a strange sense of priorities there. So really, you know, I could save this for State of the Union week. But, you know, so here's my big secret about the State of the Union address. All of the statements you see reacting to the president's State of the Union in the newspaper the next day, they were all written and delivered out before the State of the Union address.
That's right.
It's all done before. And you're like, oh, my goodness, Jim, that's fraud. No, what it is that, look, the deadline for most newspapers, particularly on the East Coast, is around 6 o'clock. Maybe they can hold it to 7 or 8. But the State of the Union address doesn't start till 8 p.m. in the evening. So what happens is the paper, you know, what you see on your front page the next morning pretty much was written the night before. They hold it in case the president has like a sneezing fit in the middle of it or something that would, you know, require that, you know, an update or something. Or, you know, if Joe Wilson gets active again, then they'd have to do that. But otherwise, all that stuff is written beforehand. And so eventually, I think we can just kind of put the entire State of the Union on tape delay.
Well, plus they do give out excerpts, though, beforehand. Yeah. So they kind of react to that. Plus, by now, I think we pretty much know where Obama's going to be on all the issues. So, Jim, have a fabulous weekend. You will be off on Monday, but we'll talk to you Tuesday.
See you Tuesday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Have a wonderful weekend and tune in on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.